Welcome to Diffuse Congruence. This is episode 147 of the American Muslim Experience. And as always, I am joined by the show's co-host, Omar Ansari.
Assalamu alaikum, Parvez. Assalamu alaikum, listeners. It's good to be here in the lovely South Bay Islamic Association, SBIA, in San Jose, California.
That's right. And we have been here a few times. Unlike those previous times, we are here in... We're in the center of it all because we are in the imam's
heart.
Office. That's
the
right.
Heart.
And we are in the imam's office. And the imam is a returning guest on the show. You'd have to go all the way back to 2016, I think episode 37, the last time. So,
of course, our dear friend, our very own Imam Tahir Anwar. Imam Tahir was born in London, England. He is an American Muslim scholar and preacher. He's lived in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1983. Imam Tahir is a scholar of Hanafi fiqh with an ijazah to teach fiqh, hadith, tafsir, and usul al-fiqh. Imam Tahir is a native Gujarati and Urdu speaker. He's also proficient in Arabic and Hindi. After completing his studies, his religious studies, Imam Tahir has served the Bay Area Muslim community since 2000 as an imam of one of the area's oldest mosques, the SBIA, the South Bay Islamic Association, where we are today. And to be clear, we've been here many times, but you've just recorded here a couple times. In addition, Imam Tahir is the founding board member of Averroes High School, the Bay Area's first Muslim high school. He's currently the chairman of the board of NISA, North American Islamic Shelter for the Abused, an organization that works toward alleviating issues related to domestic violence. In the past, Imam Tahir has served on the Human Rights Commission for the City of San Jose for over 5 years and on the Human Relations Commission for the County of Santa Clara for 1 year. He also leads groups for Hajj and Umrah. Imam Tahir joined the faculty of Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California in 2010, where he teaches Islamic law with an emphasis on the Hanafi school. Welcome, Imam Tahir.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum
salam. We're delighted to have you, and thank you so much again for taking the time. I know you're immensely busy, and we'll certainly get into what occupies a lot of your time. I guess where we like to usually start off things is kind of what we like to call the origin story. So kind of take us back. You're born in England.
Correct.
Now I know you came here around the age of 10, if I remember.
Actually younger.
Oh, younger. Okay.
That's why there's no British accent.
I actually went, I went straight to kindergarten when I got here.
Got it.
Yeah, I have some memories of school in England. Okay. I think I was in preschool.
Okay.
But when my family moved here in the early 80s, I went straight into kindergarten that first year in downtown San Jose.
How long had your parents been living in England?
My father came to England in 1972 or 73.
Okay. And he came as a religious teacher, an imam?
He did. He actually came as an imam to a masjid in Blackburn, England, which is just close to Manchester. But very soon after, he made his way to London. And I think he's lived in London, and he still maintains residence in London. So he's lived in London since 1973 or 74.
Oh, wow. So yeah. since I know we start with your origin story, but since you mentioned your father is an imam, tell us about like your family history with in terms of like religious studies.
Sure. We're actually all, we're farmers. We come from a farming background. My great grandfather was a farmer, but they were not highly educated, but they were very religious people. So religion was an important part of their lives. As a result of which, my grandfather was a scholar. He had memorized the Quran. He was he went to Darul Uloom, studied there, and actually fairly prominent in Gujarat during his time. But he always maintained his businesses and farming along with his imam career. And then of course came my father. My father started studying probably in the 50s, graduating in the mid to late 60s is my guess, from madrasa, and then eventually in the early 70s made his way to England. So that kind of makes me a third generation, da'i, teacher. My father came here very early on. And I recall a little bit of history that the only Eid in the South Bay, so I would like to say the only Eid south of San Francisco in 1983 or 84 was in San Jose, and it was in the downtown masjid. And that was it. The downtown 325 North 3rd Street masjid.
Third Street, yeah.
And that was it. Like, that was the entire most. Now, you know, mind you, I recall people praying all the way outside onto the, you know, stairs in the front grass area. But that was it. We fit the entire community in that building.
Mm-hmm. And I know you brought us to the Bay. I had a quick question. You mentioned Darul Uloom and kind of the studies that both your grandfather, you mentioned,
yes,
and your father. Is that the Darul Uloom in Deoband, or is it local in Gujarat?
No, this was in Gujarat. There was Gujarat, you know, many parts of India have some very prominent Darul Ulooms, but in Gujarat, some of the oldest Darul Ulooms, there's a, in the state of Gujarat where we're from, there's a city called Surat.
Yes.
Next to Surat, there's a very prominent town called Randir, a very wealthy town on the water. And many of these individuals had eventually at some point migrated to Burma. Mm. But this was, you know, 70, 80 years ago, maybe even 100 years ago. And Randir had two very prominent Darul Ulooms in Gujarat. So my grandfather was a graduate from there, as was my father. My grandfather's brother, youngest brother, though, my dad's uncle, was actually a direct graduate from Darul Uloom Deoband. He had actually gone up to Deoband. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned you had people migrating to Burma. And I know, like, for example, there's a sizable Gujarati origin community in places like Trinidad, places like South Africa, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. So what was it that was sort of the impetus for people migrating specifically out of like Gujarat? I mean, I know it's...
You know, Gujarat has always been on the coast.
Okay.
And I think there's a great possibility that many Gujarati Muslims are probably children of immigrants who settled in that area to begin with. You know, either Yemeni descent, Turkish descent, and that my own ancestral village has this whole Turkish a connection along with it. But in any case, I think that Gujaratis, we have a running joke that a Gujarati child is born with a passport. So, you know, they would just go out. And so we have, we have very close friends, distant family in Barbados, which is in the West Indies. Mm. My dad's been to Barbados so many times, and, you know, Barbadian Muslims, Gujarati Muslims arrived in Barbados like, you know, almost 100 years ago. Mm. My own relatives arrived in South Africa just under 100 years ago. So we have fourth, fifth generation South African Muslim cousins.
Yeah.
So in 2015, I went with my dad to South Africa just to meet that side of the family, because I'd never met them. And these are not necessarily people who come to India, because by now they're third, fourth generation.
Right.
They're kind of, you know, they're not cut off per se, but definitely the people of my generation and after, they're not very much in tune with what's happening in India. They're fourth, fifth generation.
That's right.
But because of apartheid, that lasted for so long, they've maintained the religion, the culture, the foods, the language as well.
I think
to a great extent.
Now, Gandhi himself was, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah, so yeah. He was there in South Africa. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the people who I consider a teacher, Dr. Munir Farid, I think he's like third or fourth generation.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
you're,
yeah.
You know, and he is, of course, your senior, but nonetheless, just to give you an idea of like probably how early immigration began to occur into South Africa, merchants predominantly, but also a lot of religious teachers to serve that community, that growing sort of community.
Yeah.
So your father goes to England for work or business, or is he going to, you said he goes to become an imam?
No. Why did he come to England?
Yeah, why did he go to
England? Why did he migrate to England from India? As an imam.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
There's a masjid in North England, in the town called Blackburn, that sponsored his paperwork and said, we want you to come here as an imam.
Right. Okay, and then what about the move to the U.S.? Why California?
that's a bit of an interesting story. My father... and that's what I was just looking up a little while ago. And my dad's actually shared this with me. I have all this on an audio. But my father was at Hajj in, I think, 1978. And he came across and met someone from Los Angeles. And he says, hey, you know what? We're looking for someone to come out for Taraweeh prayers. would you like to come out? And so in 1979, my father came to Inglewood, California, right outside of LAX.
Right.
And he was there. He led Tarawih there. And they said that, would you like to stay here? We'll process your green card for you. And my father actually remained there for, I think, 6 to 8 months. And he led Tarawih there. He was led the prayers there, which is why my parents have some very old family friends in Southern California. Fast forward, Dad eventually made it back to London. And, you know, he remained there. And then he gets an opportunity. He comes out to the United States with a friend. And the story he tells us is that there was a new airline that was headquartered in Atlanta, and they sold an unlimited ticket in the United States. So you could fly unlimited to any place you wanted to on that airline as long as you flew through Atlanta the whole time. So he and a friend made it out back to the United States, and they kind of went all over the country. You know, they were in Orlando, they were in Atlanta, I don't know where else they went, but eventually made it back to California. And this friend of my dad's, he had a friend in San Jose. And so he says, let's go and visit my friend. And so they're in Los Angeles, and the only two ways to get to San Jose that made sense for them at the time was get back on that flight to Atlanta and then back to the Bay Area. Wow. Or get on a Greyhound and make their way to San Jose. And my dad and his friend, his name was Ahmed, the two of them made their way to San Jose to meet a friend of theirs whose name was Abdul Sattar Raidan.
MashaAllah.
And, you know, he hosted them. They lived there. And, you know, my father says that the very day they arrived here, there was a board meeting at the masjid at SBIA, because SBIA was founded in 1978. And so, you know, the masjid, the institution had been around for a little while, and then they'd gone from building to building. So in this building where we're at right now, there's a building across the street, the flower shop, and in front of that, there's another smaller building. That was the old original SBIA in 1981.
And before 3rd Street?
Before 3rd Street.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And for one reason or another, they could not maintain that building. And so a Muslim bought off that entire building from them, cashed them out, and they took that money and went to downtown and bought the downtown building. But in any case, my father led Tarawih in San Jose, in this building, actually, the one on Oakland Road, in 1982. And, you know, he went back to England, and before you know it, 1983, the whole family moved out here. So the whole family at the time was my parents, my brother Elias, and I. Okay. And so,
do you have other siblings?
I do. I have two other siblings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. They're younger. You're the oldest of the family?
I am the eldest.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you moved out here, you mentioned starting with kindergarten. Is that public school?
Public school.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm curious.
No, there was no other option.
Yeah. 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 But I'm curious what that experience was like.
We're not judging. Believe me.
How long did you stay in public school?
I was in public school all the way through middle school.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
You know, it was pretty interesting. We lived in downtown for a little while, and then we lived in East San Jose for a few years. And, you know, public school was public school. You had all the challenges. I think when we were growing up in San Jose, the bigger challenges were just everyone just wanted to be a part of a gang. So there was a very strong gang culture. And so, you know, you knew about things. But I think my parents had certain rules, you know, immigrant parent rules.
Oh yeah.
You had to be home after school. Mm-hmm. You had to have a daily Quran lesson. You had to show them the homework that you did. They were teaching you a second language in addition to, you were required to speak the mother tongue.
These things were expected, just as like you were going to have, you're going to breathe air and have breakfast, lunch, and dinner and sleep.
Amen to that. Seriously.
It was kind of, these are all givens.
Non-negotiables.
Non-negotiables, yeah. You know. And so once we got home from school, my brother and I, we really didn't have a lot going on with the outside world. Mm-hmm. We grew up without a TV. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, there were times when you felt left out. Mm. Where even other Muslim kids kind of knew what was in and so on and so forth. So, you made it through life. I don't feel like I missed out mm-hmm. on much.
And you presumably had like some Muslim friends in the community.
We had Muslim friends. We used to hang out with them. By the way, it's not like I didn't have non-Muslim friends. Yeah. All the kids on the street were our friends. Yeah. And so in the evenings when we were done with our homework so we had a daily Quran and Islamic studies lesson. Like that was just sort of an expectation.
Your father or someone else?
Me.
Okay. Your mother.
Yeah,
sorry,
mom and
sorry.
Dad and mom, both of them. But yeah. Of course, yeah. I think... mom more than dad, okay. You know, dad was out at the masjid. He was teaching.
Yeah.
And so not to say dad didn't do anything, but you know, like we just, mm-hmm. but in any case, on days we were done early, we'd go out and we'd play on the street. So we had our bikes, we played football in the middle of the street. You know, just all the normal stuff that, you know, kids in the 80s
did. Our younger listeners are very confused right now. What?
Going outside? I was just about to say, what you're describing is a snapshot of growing up in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know.
Or 90s.
Pre-internet. Yeah, and you came home at sundown. Yeah. I mean, once you went outside, you just came home at sundown. That's just the way it was.
Right.
And if mom wanted you, she just literally opened the door and screamed out your name. And if you were not in earshot of her scream, one of your friends, non-Muslim, could hear it, and you know, boom, and you know, the ice cream trucks, and just the normal.
Yeah, love it.
So, what happens in seventh grade or junior high to?
So you know, change? We both, my brother and I, had started memorizing the Quran at home.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Very little, but you know, enough. So there was always this, you know, expectation on mom and dad's part that you would end up memorizing the Quran, and hopefully go the scholarly route, like go to a madrasa, a Darul Ulum, to study your sacred sciences. And so, you know, I think that was around the time when my father thought it was right for us to do that. But finding a Quran school in America was, you know, very difficult. I mean, there were one or two at the time, but, you know, I think dad knew that there were places better than them in other parts of the world. So dad flew us to England. We spent about 4 weeks in England. This was in 1990 or 91. I can't remember exactly. I'd like to say 1991. But we flew to England. We spent about a month in England. We checked out two Darul Ulums in England. But the plan was eventually to make it to India. My ancestral village, where my father and grandfather and great-grandfather come from, has a very prominent and a very large madrasa that was founded there. And I only found out formally that it was founded by my grandfather after my graduation from there. Yeah, we pretty much found out the backstory of how it was founded after he passed away. But if we may just really quickly, in the 1950s, my grandfather was an imam on an island in the Indian Ocean called the Reunion Island. So, west of South Africa, there's a very large island most people know is called Madagascar. Mm-hmm. Next to it is an island called Mauritius. And then next to it is a smaller island called Reunion. People from my ancestral village made it out there, I'd like to say more than 100 years ago. I actually do not know. All I know is that the vast majority of them don't speak anything but French and some English. And so my grandfather was an imam there in the 50s. They had invited him out there to be their imam. I think he was there for maybe 5-10 years. And while he was there, one of his friends, a very prominent, wealthy family, he, you know, told them that, you know, it would be good for you to sponsor and build out a madrasa in our ancestral village. And fast forward, they did. And this was, I think they started that construction maybe in the late 50s, early 60s. And it became a very prominent institution in the 80s and 90s, you know, they had some, they had found some very classical teachers. They sourced them, brought them to the institution, and it sort of became the place for many students, primarily from South Africa, to study there. So in the 80s, about a quarter of the student body was foreigners. By the way, that family to this day financially runs the institution. Mm. Yes, so they've set up a very solid endowment,
right.
And they're still, by the way, they're all in Reunion, between Paris, France, and Reunion, I'm assuming, but they're still there. But in any case, so that was the institution where we sort of ended up at, my brother and I.
You know, I almost want to, because now you got me curious to almost do a historical dive into this in terms of, you know, what were some of the earliest madrasas, if you will, or HIV schools that were founded in America? I'd be fascinated by that, because I know in Houston, for example, like, meanwhile, I'm corresponding story with mine. Yeah. You know, I think as early as the 80s, you know, we had Madrasa Islamia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you very met Hafiz Iqbal?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hafiz Iqbal, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, from Pakistan.
Yeah, yeah. I think the two big ones at the time, New Orleans, a lot of the earlier guys ended up in New Orleans. So I know, I think like Sheikh Nu'man Beg from SoCal, Sheikh Abdel Nasser, some from Qalam. I think some of these guys.
You don't know this, but so Omar is born in New Orleans.
Oh,
I lived in New Orleans in the 70s.
Okay.
So, and I'm dating Omar here, but Omar also was born in the 70s in New Orleans.
Okay.
And but so
I don't remember anything about New Orleans.
I have faint memories of New Orleans,
okay,
like you would have of England, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating that you mentioned New Orleans, because I think it
was either New Orleans or Orlando. It was in that general area, I think, one of the schools. And then Canada, I think Cornwall.
Yeah.
Cornwall was a place where they had a Quran school.
You know,
and by the way, I could be corrected, by the way.
Cornwall, okay. Yeah. I'm just, because we mentioned his name, I just want to throw this almost to preserve it, sort of posterity's
sake.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if Omar knows this, but Hafiz Iqbal, who a lot of people know Hafiz Iqbal, but of Madrasa Islamia, founder, director, still serves there. Actually, a beautiful person. The first community to sponsor him was in Miami, Florida.
Oh.
And it was my and Omar's grand uncle
who sponsored him.
Because he was very active in the Miami Pajadi, Muslim community.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just, I thought I'd mention it just because Omar and I host the show for posterity's sake.
Okay.
So yeah, he had, because our grand uncle had come here in the 50s. So anyway. Sorry, a lot of tangents, but...
No.
I didn't know that, but that's good.
That's awesome. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So we end up, my brother and I end up in our ancestral village in India to do our HIV at this madrasa.
Are you going willingly and... Absolutely.
So my father had a rule. He said, listen, I want you to memorize the Quran, but like, I only want you to do it if you want to and if you like it.
Mm.
So my brother and I are in India that first year. I have to admit, it was probably one of the more difficult years of my life. My mom came with us, by the way. Mm. Now, this is my ancestral town. So, you know, my Nana and Nani, my mom's parents are still alive. They're there. My dad's father is still there.
Nice.
And so we're not living in the dorms. We're at home.
Yeah.
But most of our friends at the time were either our cousins or other foreigners. So we had friends from Toronto. We had friends from England. We had friends from South Africa. And so we were the English speaking. And we were all, you know, some of us were memorizing the Quran, others were doing, you know, their higher studies. But I mean, because we were so close to each other, we've actually remained friends for life since then.
And at the same time, you know Gujarati, so you can, you were kind of able
Gujarati,
to.
I knew Gujarati, yes. Interestingly enough, 3 years before then, my parents had gone to India for about 6 months. And within those 6 months, I actually learned how to read and write Gujarati.
Oh, wow.
This was when I was way back in third or fourth grade.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting experience. I think I must say, though, you know, I've been asked, like, what was so difficult? I think for me personally, the greatest difficulty was food.
Mm.
I just couldn't get used to the food there, as weird as that sounds. You know, missing my cereal, my cookies. Yeah. I mean, you have to understand, this was very early. This was sort of pre-modern, you know.
India.
Yeah. And things changed in India really, really fast in the 90s and early 2000s. But prior to that, it was still very old school. And so, you know.
I lived in India for 2 years, so I had sort of a similar sort of experience where pre-fast food, no American food whatsoever could be found in India. So yeah, very much.
I mean, I got a really lot. Crazy at some point when I found out that there was a Domino's in New Delhi.
Okay.
I got on a 24-hour train to go to New Delhi just to have a Domino's pizza, and got on another 24-hour train and came back. Like that was a big deal. Do you get what I'm saying? Like it was such a big deal, you know?
I can imagine.
It was very different, but fast forward, we're there for a year. We come back to England where we meet our father. And it was in that decade my parents had decided to move back to England. My father pretty much asked us and said, do you wish to continue? I actually recall this conversation very vividly.
So it took you a year. You had completed the HIVs.
No. I think I got done maybe with 5 or 6 Jews.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Ramadan break came around. So you're
back in.
We fly back with mom and, we're back in England. And
that's when your father poses the question.
Yeah, dad. And, mom and dad have a house there. So we go straight home. And, dad goes, like, do you want to continue? Do you see yourself? And I'm like, absolutely. I mean, I've spent a year doing this. Seems like something I can definitely do. Why not? Okay, where do you want to continue? Do you want to go back to India or not? Or do you want to just enroll yourself in a madrasa here in England? And I think America was never an option for us for some odd reason. It was, because the institutions were far more larger, solidified, older.
In England.
Yeah. And so I actually don't recall why, but we decided to make our way back to India. By then we'd actually gotten used to it. And it was in 1993 or 94 where I completed my HIV. Just over 2 years that I recall. It must have been 1993. But just over 2 years, we had completed our HIV. And then soon again, so when we completed our HIV, we came back home. Home at the time was England. And, dad posed a very simple question. Would you like to continue studying in a madrasa or do you want to go back to school? What do you want to do? But I think by then we were in that environment. Mm. We were, and it's just sort of a natural, a transition that after you're finished with your HIV, you go on to do your further Islamic studies. And fast forward, we just... that's what we did.
And you went back to India for that?
Back to India, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So how long in total then did you spend after HIV?
I was in India until the end of 1999. So I was there for another 6 years.
Okay.
Lots of challenges, and health.
In those 6 years, is that like I didn't mean to cut
you off.
No,
not at all.
But I'm just curious because, we've had others who've, gone the similar sort of route, trajectory, as it were. This is sort of the Dars-e-Nizami.
The Dars-e-Nizami.
Okay. Yes. And it takes about 6 years? Or...
Yeah, honestly, the program in our madrasa was actually 10 years. Mm. 1 year of nothing but Urdu, 2 years of Persian, followed by 7 years of Arabic and Hadith and so on studies. Now, as foreigners, we wouldn't want to be there for that long to begin with, issues with visas and so on. Now, so my parents were of Indian origin, as a result of which at the time we ended up getting a 5-year, visa to be there.
Okay.
What most foreigners would do is knock out the Urdu piece in their final year of HIVs. On the side. So on our days off, we'd find ourselves. So I had a very close older friend from England who I'm extremely grateful to. He he's a teacher, mentor, a very close friend now. But of course, he kind of took us under his wing and he said, listen, if you guys feel like you want to do this, let me start teaching you so you can save a little bit of time. And so I studied all the prerequisite Urdu with him. In fact, we started a lot of Arabic with him as well in his apartment. I still recall this. And so on our days off, you know, we'd go there to study with him. Mm. And the way he would encourage us is that he would cook for us. You know, I'm, you know, as young kids, I guess I just took it for granted. But now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like I owe him so much more. Yeah. You know, he really That's took care nice. Of us. He fed us, and you know, and he taught us as well. And so by the time my hifz was complete, we got into our directly into year one of Arabic grammar studies, and that was a 7-year program, but we managed to combine 2 years in one.
Okay.
Years 4 and 5, we combined in one. And again, that was a complete exception to the rule that they made for some of the foreigners because we had issues around visas and so on and so forth.
What was spoken at home? I'm just curious because I'm wondering.
Gujarati at home.
Okay.
Urdu and Arabic in the madrasa.
Okay. Okay. But at home, you hadn't grown up speaking Urdu.
You know, it's interesting. My parents, while we were here in San Jose, I think they kind of prepared us. They felt very strongly about teaching us Urdu.
Okay.
So as I probably started learning Urdu for... I actually knew how to read and write Urdu before I knew how to read and write Gujarati.
Okay.
My parents, I think maybe I must have been in 2nd or 3rd grade when we started learning Urdu at home. And reading and writing.
Because I'm wondering if that helped facilitate, you know, the advanced Urdu that you would do later on.
Yeah, as well, part you have to understand, you know, a lot of the Islamic studies books at the time were not in English. There was nothing in English.
Yeah.
Or there was, you know, but it was very little. And Urdu had so much more for young children. And as a result of that, it was kind of like, okay, let's teach the kids Urdu so they can, you know, get all their Islamic knowledge. So by the time I was in 4th or 5th grade, I was reading some, not advanced, but pretty advanced for my age, Urdu books, Talimul Islam and things like that. I was reading that and I knew all my, you know, in Urdu, as they say, masail, all my stipulations around prayer, fasting. I knew all of that by the time I was in 4th and 5th grade.
Asan fiqh or something.
Yeah. Asan fiqh, exactly.
Yeah. Fascinating. And even the translations that were available, even of those texts, if I recall, in English were weak translations. Bless the people who translated them. But I mean, you know, like, I mean, I used to read, like, my first foray into learning on my own was my uncle taking me to a bookstore in Hyderabad and buying me just a whole bunch of books. And vast majority of them were, you know, Hasan Ali Nadwi.
Yeah. And you remember those, the typesetting and the translation.
Thank you.
Were two things that just turned you off from reading the book to begin with. I'm you know, again,
no, you're
because we were used
right.
to a much higher standard in it. Oh, so I have to admit, actually, now, there was an institution in South Africa at the time that was called YMMA, Young Muslim Men's Association, in Benoni. And they had published some very good books on early fiqh in the English language.
Oh, okay.
And my parents had actually gotten their hands on some of those. Okay. But that was all unexpected, right? But the Urdu we learned was specifically so that we could study. And so we did have a bit of a, you know, a head start, if we may, in the Urdu language.
Okay.
So let's move to, like, your return back to the U.S. Well, your turn out of India, how did you decide it was the U.S., first of all?
Yeah.
And then what brought you back specifically to the Bay Area?
So there's a bit of a backstory. My father, when he left the United States in 1991, he actually didn't come back until 1996. In fact, when he left America in 1991, he didn't think he was going to come back at all. So he pretty much wrapped everything up, and he said, the biggest thing was that we have no family here, zero family. And we have a lot of family in England. And mom specifically, you know, was both mom and dad, but mom specifically was like, you know, we want to be around family. And so that's kind of why after living in the U.S. for almost a decade, just under a decade, they had moved back to England.
And what's it, what part of England?
London.
London, okay.
Oh, yeah, we've always lived in London.
I think I mentioned this to you off air, but, you know, we want to kind of weave in some of the history of the Bay Area as through your story.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, when your father was serving as imam here, did the community expand into the third the Third Street space at that point?
Yeah, so Third Street happened in 82, 83.
Okay, so you were still here.
We had just arrived.
Oh, in just fact, arrived.
The Third Street building had just happened. There was an apartment upstairs that was prepared for us to move into in 1983. We lived up there for 3 years before we moved to East San Jose. It was the only masjid south of San Francisco, north of Los Angeles.
I've heard that outside of San Francisco, the original downtown South, SPIA is the oldest masjid in the Bay Area.
It is the oldest masjid in the Bay Area. Okay. Correct.
The oldest being in San Francisco.
The oldest being on Crescent Street in San Francisco.
Crescent Street.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is not no longer exists, right?
No, it exists. Oh, it absolutely does. Yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So not, what's the other one? Jones? No.
No, Jones. Jones came much later.
Jones came later.
Okay. Happened in the
90s. I only heard about Crescent through like... Jeffrey Lang talked
okay.
about his
yeah,
book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That's a very OG masjid.
Yeah.
It's a very OG masjid. In fact, they had no imam. One of their first khatibs was a Gujarati uncle who used to live in San Francisco. One of the board members, early board members at the Islamic Center of San Francisco, was one of the founders of the South Bay Islamic Association, Uncle Mertz Dahlin. He was a Caucasian American. Yes. And so some very interesting history here. Mm-hmm.
Originally European.
Right? He was originally European.
Danish or something? I forget.
Yeah. And his wife was Turkish.
God bless him. Yeah. He was such a beautiful person.
Yeah. I mean. And so this was San Jose. And then I think soon after Masjid An-Nur, MCA happened, 1984.
Okay.
But this was all one community, so that became an offshoot. MCA happened soon after that. But MCA at the time was just Masjid An-Nur on Catherine Street. Mm-hmm. And MCA, the building on Scott, happened in the mid-90s. And then the masjid that happened after that was the ISEB, Islamic Society of East Bay, the Lowry Masjid. But of course, they were not in that area. They happened to... they were in multiple rental places before they eventually... In fact, I would say what some of the brothers in Fremont in 1983, 84, when Ramadan was in the summer and it was just too long for them to come out here, they started Taraweeh in their homes.
In Fremont,
in their garage. One specific brother, who's still around, by the way, lives on 680 and Mission. He started Taraweeh in his home, Nazim uncle. And then soon after, so ISEB then kind of happened, the brothers got together. And then after that, it's just kind of been, every community. I think Milpitas came after that, Darussalam.
I moved here in 2000, and it's amazing because by then, very quickly in the 90s, things explode.
Even though
what you're describing is only a few years prior to my arrival in the Bay Area, it feels like so much earlier because things were still just in the infancy.
Right.
And then after, I think we're just over 125 masjids and musallas in the Bay Area.
Really?
If not under 150. Okay. Yeah, we're just somewhere, we're between the 125, 150 number. So of course, the community's grown.
I just discovered a musalla / masjid in Palo Alto. Jamil Sufi.
So Uncle Jamil's masjid is very old.
Yes.
Uncle Jamil and his children used to study Quran with my dad.
Subhanallah. I met his son.
Adam.
Adam.
Yeah, and I grew up together.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Okay. We had just gotten eating at Zareen's and we needed a place to pray.
It's like right next door.
It's right next door to Zareen's. Yeah. So sorry, but it's a fascinating little musalla.
Yeah, that's been around. Uncle Jamil had a very, very sudden, death.
They used to have a carpet.
They used to have a carpet store.
And I think their sheikh told them to create a musalla, so they did outside of that shop that they used to run.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a fascinating story, and hopefully a future episode of the show. So just throwing that out there as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, coming back to you. What prompted?
So yes. Yeah. So 1996, Dad comes to the U.S. And, people are like, oh, can you, what are your children? Where are your children? Oh, mashallah, they're studying. Oh, they're Hafiz. Oh, can you bring them out for Taraweeh? So I think it was in 1997, my brother and I came here for Taraweeh Our first Taraweeh that we led in the Bay Area was at the old Ibrahim Khalilullah Islamic Center, IKIC, when it was in a different... this is the masjid that's right next to Ta'lif.
No, yeah, I'm familiar. But it wasn't there.
It was not there. Okay. It was on... I'm forgetting. It was on... it was very close to the Lowry Masjid where it's at today. I'm forgetting the exact location. It was in a strip mall. We led Taraweeh there. And that year, 1997, the Hafiz who was leading Taraweeh at SBIA for some reason was just having some problems. Okay. So the Afghan style, Ilyas and I, my brother and I, we finished Taraweeh there. We made the khatam there in 13 nights. And on the 14th night, we were at 3rd Street, downtown San Jose, starting Taraweeh once again from like the 11th juz. And that was in after my fifth year of studies. And then we came back after, the sixth year, we came back that Ramadan. And then in my final year of studies, the president of SBIA at the time, a Bangladeshi brother by the name of Mahbub Khan, but this is not the Mahbub Khan that was associated to MCA. This is a different Mahbub Khan. He sent me an offer letter. And I graduated and November or December of 1999, I came out here, led Taraweeh, took a few months off, and formally started my position as the Imam of SBIA in April of 2000.
I'm smiling or laughing a little because, we've talked to other people. I'll just say, like on the last episode, we talked to Sheikh Jamal Diwan.
Yeah.
And one of the things we were joking about after he completes his studies in Azhar Sharif was there's no LinkedIn where you can go, right? You made the joke about no LinkedIn being available. You sort of had an offer letter in hand, while you were still going to school. So you were like one of those, people who intern and then, HP turns around and says, okay, we're going to hire you.
I was very young at the time. Yeah. SBIA took a massive risk on me.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Complete inexperienced. Lived abroad for many years, had a lot of room for improvement. But some of the older community that was, some of the founders of SBIA who were still very active, Sattar Raidan uncle, Khalid Thai uncle, some of the Abdullah Qazi uncle, some of these people who were still on the board at the time, and many others, by the way, but these were prominent individuals on the board at the time or on the board of trustees. They kind of said, hey, listen, let's bring this kid and I guess take our chances. And wow. You'd have to ask them how it turned out.
Well, we're still here. So, I'm sure it turned out great. Alhamdulillah. How was that transition like, coming in as a, like you mentioned, young, sort of right out of school, fresh graduate, if you will. One of the things I wanted to ask, so, because we talked about you going to public school till middle school, were you just being sort of homeschooled, while you were doing your studies?
No, school was done. I've only been to school until middle school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So after that, it was all Islamic studies.
All Islamic studies.
So then my question then even seems even more pertinent in terms of, as someone who is not only fresh out of school, but largely disconnected with life in America, with the community members, people even your age, like how do you acclimate to that? I mean, what was that like?
So, we had started coming back 2 years prior to that. And so, and we'd be here for 4 to 6 weeks at a time. And so, again, we went right back to our friends, our old childhood friends. So acclimation, we kind of got it. Right. Cause we'd always lived here. Right.
Yeah.
So true. It wasn't that hard. But yeah. Clearly, you could tell, it was different.
I mean, I met you in around 2001, 2002. I specifically remember the class that Sheikh Mohammed Yaqubi had at in SBIA on history.
Okay, yeah.
Do you remember that class?
Yeah, I remember that.
I met a lot of people in this community in that class.
Oh, I had no idea.
Might have met you before then, but that's I specifically remember.
Did you ever take a Hanafi fiqh class at Zaytuna Institute by any chance?
Yeah. You did.
Yeah. So Sheikh...
maybe.
Okay, yeah, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqubi was supposed to teach that class. He could not make it. And so Dr. Hatim Bazian, who used to frequent SBIA, knew of this young kid who had just graduated and he had studied Hanafi fiqh. And he just recruited him to teach Hanafi fiqh at Zaytuna Institute way back in 2000 or 2001. And that was my beginning with Zaytuna. That was my introduction to Zaytuna. And Dr. Ali Atai, who's currently the dean and the vice president at Zaytuna College, I don't recall, but he tells me that he was in that class.
Wow. Okay. We've had him on the show a couple of times, but that's an amazing story.
But the reason I even mentioned all I'm saying is my first impression wasn't that you were like some imam from over there.
Okay.
Like, yeah. So it was to kind of connect what Pervez's question was, like, how did you acclimate?
Right.
I think the reality is you were from here. You're just a kid from here who went there to study, but had roots here. Yeah. So that's kind of connecting the dots.
No, because I think, it certainly lends itself to a broader conversation that I think we still have in the community about sort of, indigenizing Islam and, and creating homegrown leadership and things like that. So I think, which is why I pose the question to you, is obviously someone as you travel and you speak, to other Muslim communities as well. I imagine those are conversations that are still occurring, in terms of having leadership in the masjid that can be, that is relatable to young people, to people who've been born and raised here, even people like me, who's old enough as the community is aged and old.
And I think just full circle on that, we talked a little about this last in our last episode, starting 20 years ago, always important for the imam to relate to the culture here. Yeah. But I think what I realize as I get older, and I think one of the values that makes you really unique and special is that you relate to the folks here, but you also relate
to the elderly over
there. And I think, like what we talked about, what Parvez and I have been talking about, is just the ability to that cohesiveness to bring it all together. Yeah. Because now we've kind of got a little fragmented, right? It's either or and not both. Mm-hmm. And I think the value comes in connecting all the dots, because we're really all one. We should all be one, right? And elders learning from youth, and youth learning from elders, and mutual benefit.
You know, a friend of mine actually told me this many years into my career, which I didn't realize was happening. And what helped me in my career was that my father had been an imam for many years in the West, and had been an imam in America, and of all places, at the very masjid that I was serving.
Yeah.
And so the amount of advice that I got from, I feel like the reason I've been able to be so successful is because Dad knew exactly what needed to be done or said. And he always gave us feedback. Oh, you said this in your khutbah. This is how you phrase it. This is not what you say. You should recite this surah in prayer. Make it short. Make it easy for the people. You got some issue going on. And then you have all these recollections of just Dad's career, of how he dealt with things. Because my dad would always come home and talk about things. Right. He wouldn't mention names, but And so a lot of my being mentored directly, indirectly, was through my dad's experiences, or just directly calling Dad and talking to him, which really, really helped. But you talk about the beginning of my career. I started in April of 2000, and it was just getting used to new things. In hindsight, I wish I had maybe done things a little differently. I wish I had gone back to school. But it was just that the whole imam job became so infused. And I think, there wasn't anyone young at the time, or someone who spoke English the way I did, not to say there wasn't, that there was this massive demand of this person. And I just became infused in the community. But soon after, 9/11 happened.
Right. I just want to say April 2000. Right.
Yeah, and so I've always explained to people and saying it's almost I was a minor leaguer, just getting started, thrown into the major leagues overnight.
Yeah,
and I was just swinging.
Right.
So you had to do a lot of representing the community in front of the mic, right?
Far more than I'm comfortable doing now. As I'm getting older now, I'm avoiding the mic. I'm avoiding cameras. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm not, there's, mashallah, there's a lot of amazing representation now, but you have to understand this was 22 years ago when the only people that were speaking were maybe less than a handful of individuals,
Yeah.
The care executive director at the time, completely different individual, myself, maybe one, you know.
You're saying locally here in the Bay.
Locally, yeah. You know, ING, Sister Maha. There was just a handful of us who were in front of the camera and speaking to people. And it just, it almost felt like it needed to be done. It had to be done. You had no other choice.
Absolutely. And not to mention the, or I'm being a little vulnerable here, but, you know, the incessant sort of feedback and criticism of, well, you didn't say this and you didn't say that correctly. Yeah, and when you're tasked with the impossible, which is being thrown into the majors, I think it's a great analogy. You're obviously going to have slip ups. And you know, it's because.
But, you know, you built these relationships. I knew this, you know, in the early 2000s, I knew the city council of San Jose far better than I do now. Okay. I just became you know, sort of that outreach person.
Yeah.
The religious leadership, the civic leadership, just the general community leadership within the community, you know, non-Muslim community, not Muslim community. Yeah. And I think I did that for the next almost 9 or 10 years. That I just became very, very, well, maybe not 9 or 10 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, but that's what I became just really busy with, in addition to all my responsibilities at the masjid. But I may add one thing really quickly is that I have to thank and appreciate and honor the leadership at SBIA who allowed me to do those things. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times masjid boards will hold you back and say, no, you can't do that. You can't be the one on the camera. It has to be this board member. Or how come you aren't here for the prayer? Oh, you need to be here for the khutbah. You can't go and do the khutbah at San Jose State University or something like that. But SBIA's leadership has always sort of been, go serve the community. We can always find someone to lead the prayer or do a khutbah. But if you feel that you're better serving the needs of the community within our area, please, you know, go be the spokesperson.
But was your affiliation 100% with SBIA at
this
time?
My affiliation was 100% with SBIA. Okay.
It's fascinating. I think in so many ways, it's almost as if the things you're saying in this episode will serve as sort of it's in conversation with our last episode.
Yeah.
Because I think, because one of the things that Sheikh Jamal talked about was precisely the opposite of what you're describing at SBIA. Which was nurturing or investing in leadership and giving the imam the ability to go out there in the community, you know, because
totally encouraged it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I remember he sort of anecdotally referenced was, you know, you can get anyone to lead Maghrib prayer, but if I'm having dinner with like a family or if I'm having lunch with the youth, I mean that's community work. And to be ostracized for that because you weren't leading prayers,
it's SBIA it's refreshing. Complete opposite, right? SBIA's leadership has always been, you know, you also have to understand, and again, this is probably for those that are listening to this, but we do live in the Silicon Valley. These are very highly educated people. Yeah. You know, they understand and value some of these things. So they, you know, they've always been like, Imam Tahir, go build the relationships, you know, go do what you got to do in order to make, you know, you're a community leader. Yes, we would like you to lead the prayers. Yes, we don't want you to be missing all the prayers, but you're also a community leader. And so go lead, go do what you have to make that happen. We're not going to hold you back. And which is why when I started, you know, at the time, you know, started, I was teaching classes at Zaytuna Institute. They were completely open to the idea. I can almost see other Muslim employers, masjids, restricting their imams from doing such things and saying, why are you teaching there? Why are you not here? And, you know, for SBIA's leadership, they were like, oh, our imam also happens to be teaching classes at Zaytuna Institute. Which then, you know, was a completely different, we can fast forward at some point, you know, change gears later on. Yeah. But what led me into Zaytuna College? But it was these classes that led me into Zaytuna Institute. I was doing khutbahs at various different mosques. You know, if MCA would reach out to me and say, hey, can you deliver a khutbah here? Totally. So SBI was completely open to the idea, which allowed me, I have to say, which allowed me to become who I am as an individual.
For sure.
Professionally speaking, although I attribute any little success that I do have to the prayers of my parents, more importantly than anything else. But from a suburb perspective, from a means perspective, you know, I have to thank the leadership here as well.
So what were some of the first, you mentioned Averroes, Zaytuna, Nissa, what were some of the, what were the,
Well, he hasn't mentioned him. We've mentioned him in the bio. Yeah, so maybe if anything, you might want to flesh that out. But
So we know you've been involved in these other organizations such as Zaytuna and Averroes and so forth. What was your first foray into kind of the Muslim organization that isn't a masjid? And what was that experience like being outside of a masjid environment and in sort of this nonprofit 501c3 sure. with a different purpose? What was that
so
like?
So 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and for the next week, the Muslim leadership, just anyone that had any prominence, anything to contribute, there was an institution at the time called American Muslims for Global Peace and Justice, AMGPJ, okay. Which ceases to exist now, which was founded, if my recollection serves me, it was founded by Mahbub Khan, Rahmatullah Ali, of MCA. Mm. But of course, he had passed away in the late 90s. And they used to have offices in Santa Clara on Walsh. And we met there, I think, for 4, 5, 6, 7 days every evening, just kind of planning, what are we going to do tomorrow? How do we deal with the media, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was sort of my first introduction into the nonprofit world very soon into my career.
Mm.
In fact, I think they had asked me to sit on the board as well at the time. I don't even know if I did or not. I can't recall. And then the way my career sort of led me was a Granada Islamic School had an opening for an Islamic studies teacher. And I applied and I got the job, which got me into education. I have to, just very quickly, one of the things Granada was really good at the time, and I'm sure they still are, I just don't know, just professional training. And so I remember taking all these trainings, because I was never trained to be a teacher, a teacher in a public school system. But I taught there for a few years. And I recall, we talk about Nissa just very quickly. Talking about domestic violence, and a lot of women would come to the masjid and they were victims of domestic violence. And so I started delivering khutbas on domestic violence and getting into not a lot of trouble. I think it would be incorrect for me to say that, but there was a bit of a backlash from individuals in the community. And so that's sort of that's how I began my, speaking up for Nissa. In fact, Nissa right there gave me, what is it, a community service award? What year is that?
Community 2005. Service award from 2005. Yeah,
2005. So this is like, I was speaking about domestic violence way back then.
Wow.
And by the way, I didn't even go there to receive that. I had to be somewhere else. And you can see it says Nissa of ISNA, because Nissa used to be a part of ISNA back in the day.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yes, right there. It says North American Islamic Shelter for the Abused of ISNA. Islamic Society of right. North America. Yeah. And so in any case, my teaching at Granada ended in 2010, 2011. And then I Averroes, you were part of Averroes from very early on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, just for a bit, yeah.
For a bit, yeah. And so, Averroes, I still remember Brother Hazim and Sister Reem came by. They talked to me about Averroes High School, got really excited. So somehow I was sort of on that founding board of Averroes. And then around that time, I think Nissa asked me to join their board. And I've been on their board for many years. But if I may, just very quickly... Zaytuna Institute was transitioning from an institute into the college.
Right.
And in 2009, if I'm not mistaken,
mm-hmm. yeah.
they brought together about 15, 17 people in the community, and they had what they referred to at the time as a management committee. And it was that management committee was tasked with helping the institute transition into a college. And I was a part of that. And then when the transition happened and the college was formally formed, Imam Zaid and Sheikh Hamza asked if I could teach Hanafi fiqh at the college. And so began a completely, what I thought would, I just started teaching what's you know, that journey, that which has become a very prominent part of my life at this, at, you know, right now, that just being associated with Zaytuna College.
And just to provide the details there, you teach...
I teach Hanafi fiqh.
Is it like one class per semester?
It's one class per semester.
Yeah. And on an ongoing basis.
On an ongoing basis.
So students there are able to choose which school?
Yeah, you have an option to pick one. Well, you know, we should say you have the option to pick one of four schools, but up until now, no one has opted for a Hanbali. Mm. They've opted for Maliki, Shafi'i, or Hanafi, and we have fiqh classes for all three schools of thought.
There's so much we could, I think, unpack with you, but given the fact that we're all a little bit on a time crunch, but we're also approaching the month of Ramadan.
Yes,
we
absolutely.
We are recording this contingent on moon sighting. So I wanted to transition the conversation there. And I want to say also this, like the conversations that we've been having, I want to continue this. So
okay,
I'm going to hold you to bringing you back, and it's not going to be 7 years before we get you back on the show. So inshallah, we will put a pin in it, if you will.
Sure.
Because I think you have so much history about the Bay Area. I mean, we're a little partial to it. And so I think you being here as long as you have, and obviously boots on the ground, have so much of that history. So definitely want to bring you
Inshallah,
back.
Inshallah, absolutely.
But again, I think for the benefit of our listeners and first and foremost for our benefit, we'd love to sort of, you know, as I said, transition into talking about the month of Ramadan.
Sure.
So if I could, then, you know, I know we're a little late to the game in terms of asking this question, but for those who listen, perhaps they can apply some of this, inshallah, God willing, next year, which is about preparations for Ramadan beginning, you know, in Rajab.
Right? Correct.
So I guess maybe talk a little bit about that and, you know, what we gather from our tradition with regards to truly making, you know, preparations in Rajab and Sha'ban, which then bear fruit in the month of Ramadan, inshallah.
Sure. So subhanAllah, we talk about Rajab and Sha'ban, and then of course that leads into Ramadan. And clearly we all know that Ramadan happens to be a time, what I've learned from my teachers is a time of direct act of ibadah and worship, right? Indirect, definitely, but direct acts of ibadah, and specifically, you know, fasting, Quran, tilawah, tarawih, tahajjud, and so on and so forth. But all of these things can be, you know, for the average human being, they can be slightly difficult. I mean, waking up at 4 a.m, fasting during the day, getting in a little bit of extra tilawa or so on, or whatever it may be. And so Sharia then sort of, you know, encourages us and says, start getting ready for Ramadan from the month of Rajab. Start reaping the blessings just so that, and you know, almost like an excuse that you're not just turning the switch on in Ramadan. It's kind of like, you know, let's ease into this. Mm-hmm. It's warm up. It's warm up before a game is what it comes down to, right? Yeah. You have pro ball players
preseason
or pro ball players before the game. They're warming up. You know,
spring training.
Yeah, there you go. Spring training is what's happening, and you know, again. And this is not just for Ramadan. This is also just like an excuse for you to increase your worship, not just in Ramadan, but sort of, you know, becomes your habit. But I think another thing is that, you know, because the idea in Islam is that, you know, that Ramadan, the time in Ramadan is so valuable and should not be wasted, that if there are things that you can wrap up before Ramadan, go wrap it up before Ramadan. So, you know, truth be told, earlier this afternoon, my dad had a doctor's appointment, which got postponed. And so, I told my wife, I said, hey, I've got the afternoon off. And she's like, oh, you know what? Like, there's this one thing I need to pick up. You know, I just want to be done with this before Ramadan so we don't have to deal with it in Ramadan. If you can drive me, it'll be quicker, easier. Let's do it. I said, yeah, absolutely. And so that's what we did. And then she's like, let's go get some ice cream together because we're not going to be able to do this until after Ramadan. And I'm like, okay, you know.
This is really tangible, good advice. It's like... Yeah. Very practical, like appointments and getting ahead on studying for that exam that's happening on the second week of Ramadan, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Finishing up projects.
No, totally. It makes like, total sense. I'm, you know, I was.
And
just,
I know there's female listeners going, oh, it's so cute that the imam still makes time for ice cream with his wife. So.
Well, actually, now that you bring it up, truth be told, we actually ended up at nothing but cake. and we picked up a little cake, and then we went to the ice cream shop.
Way to
and
go.
I really wasn't feeling the ice cream, and she's like, oh, you're not having anything? I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll have something too, you know? And so, but you know, it's those little things. I'm trying to wrap up all my, you know, I live with my parents, alhamdulillah, and so, you know, they have numerous doctor's appointments. I've had, I think I covered 4 doctor's appointments today alone between mom and dad. So just trying to really wrap things up before Ramadan, just so, you know, not for, and honestly, sometimes during Ramadan, I'm kind of just relaxed, doing nothing. Just being able to, like, after Asr, when you have a nice Californian breeze and the sun is coming down, for me to be able to just take my lounge chair and just sit outside and not have to worry about wrapping something up, whatever it may be. So it's not just about the spiritual prep, but I also believe it's about the physical sort of preparation, just so that you're not necessarily wasting time doing unnecessary things during Ramadan, because Ramadan, it's all heightened rewards. You know, everything's on overdrive. So why would you be walking down the mall picking up something, you know?
Yeah, that's really, really good practical advice. It's, now this year, we're getting closer back to the shorter,
shorter days. Yeah, 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 exactly.
We made it, alhamdulillah, we made it through the summer.
Through the summer,
and for those in your other hometown, London, they made it through their very long summers. But do you think, what is the main shift as the days get shorter? Like, is there anything that you noticed or advice you'd give related to the days getting shorter? Personally, before 2009 or 10, I would always stay after Fajr and go to work, you know? And then that just became impossible at some point.
Yeah.
I'm personally excited about, like, getting back to that, inshallah, this year.
Inshallah.
But is there anything like that related to the time that you might want
to offer? So, you know, I think that you will find more. So it gets a little tricky. Shorter days basically means that you're probably making iftar. Well, I mean, these days, Maghrib will still be enough where people will be able to get home. But, you know, I think I find more people showing up for Isha and Taraweeh. And you're able to get in 5 to 6 hours of sleep if you manage your schedule well. Assuming you make it home by 11.
We're still there.
Isha is going to be 9:15 or 9:15 in Ramadan.
But that's better than what, 10:15?
It's better than 10:15. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you get an hour up, and then you get a little bit. So basically, if you're in bed by 11:30, and even if you have to get up by 4:30, you've gotten 5 hours of some solid sleep.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're not making it for Taraweeh and you're in bed by 10:30 or 11, right? You're getting. So I think, physically speaking, I think for most people, it's just that they're not exhausted at the end of the day. What does that translate to? That translates to them just not worried about sleeping, right? It translates to I can open up the Mus'haf. I can read a book. You know, people are buying books to see what they can read this Ramadan or whatever it may be. And so they're able to do some of those things. That's sort of the big.
Since you mentioned that, though, would you advise people to do that? I mean, you often hear, you know, the month of Ramadan is the month of the Quran. So, and we know traditionally speaking, even schools, institutions of learning would close learning except for Tilawatul Quran.
Absolutely.
Would you
advise going to sleep or advise?
No, I meant reading other books.
So I say that because I'm assuming we have a very vast array of listeners.
We do, for sure.
But let's just put it this way. When I told my grandfather that he asked me how many juz I was reciting per day, and I told him that I was doing 10 per day, he was extremely disappointed.
Really?
As a hafiz, he said, the expectation is that you should be making one khatam a day. Which was the practice of Abu Hanifa and others, Imam Shafi'i, others, right? They would get in one khatam. You know, if you average out one juz at 20 minutes, you know, it's about 10 hours for the entire khatam to say, and their argument is you can't make 10, you have 24 hours in a day, you can't find 10 to read the Quran, you know?
But your takeaway is that, back to the time, the days are shorter, enjoy the benefit of that, but that also means more responsibility.
Yeah, like, right? You know, this, here's my, you know, I tell, look, it is, like Pervez mentioned, it is the month of the Quran, so please do an extra recitation. You know, go to the masjid for, go at least for Isha prayer. You know, my encouragement has always been to people, please just at least, don't be so lazy that you're not even going for Isha. And then if after Isha is done, you can stick around for a little bit of Tarawih, because listen, there is that whole argument and debate around Tarawih, you know, is it 8, is it 20, or is it even 8, or, you know, all I'm saying is, if you can stay, look, Tarawih, you only pray Tarawih in Ramadan.
Yeah.
So why not stick around for a little?
Yeah.
And at some point, look, and I my basic argument with people is, or, you know, recommendation is, if you're going to leave Tarawih prayers, it should be to go home and going to work or to sleep, not so you could hang out in the parking lot, you know? And so I was just saying this to someone the other day, that I have been, you know, we're finding a growing trend of suhoors, suhoor parties, suhoor fests, qiyams, you know, qiyam is supposed to be prayer. The Western American Muslim qiyam basically means a little bit of prayer, a lot of talks, and then like food trucks for suhoor, right? And so now I come from a very, very conservative tradition. No,
I think we can have, I you know, I think you should be very comfortable setting the bar where
you get what I'm saying. So here's what I do, right? And I said this at West Valley the other day. I said, listen, after Tarawih prayers, now I may not stay for all 20. I'll just be honest with you. I may stay for 4, I may stay for 8, I may stay for 16, I may stay for 20. But once I leave prayers, I'm going home. And once I get home, if I'm maybe a little hungry, I get a bite to eat or something. If I need to really quickly check my email, just kind of wrap up the day, but I'm in bed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you're inviting me to your grand qiyam at your local masjid, Imam Tahir is not showing up. I don't do late night talks. My late nights, I'll be honest, are for sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not. You won't find me at home at 1 a.m. praying. At 1 a.m, you're going to find me sleeping. Very simple. But I am generally, everyone in the household is waking up 45 to 60 minutes before suhoor. That's just a general standard at home. Mm-hmm. You know, you wake up, you're not just running. You freshen up. Mm-hmm. You go have your suhoor. You know, like have it relaxed.
Yeah.
You know, the way food is supposed to be eaten, right?
Yeah.
Mindful, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Have your suhoor, maybe have a little conversation with the family. You know, it's early morning. It's not like you're having a long conversation, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
be able to make wudu and then have some time for tahajjud.
Mm.
The time for tahajjud, as Imam Shafi'i says, dua made at tahajjud is like a arrow that reaches its target. Like, why mm-hmm. would you,
mm-hmm.
why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, if someone gave me, you know, a free car wash every day, I would figure out a way to get through it, you know?
Yeah.
And so tahajjud is, so for me, honestly, like, there's two things that are really big for me personally in Ramadan that generally I don't waste. My tahajjud prayers, specifically, and the dua before Salat al-Maghrib, before iftar. Like, those are my two...
Mm.
And of course, during the day, prayers, tilawat, and all of that. But sure. Like, these are two voluntary, right? There's the obligatory. But my two voluntary things that I've been trained, raised with to not waste. Your tahajjud prayers and your dua at the time of iftar. And we're not talking about a 2-minute, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
Our definitions are clear. You're defining tahajjud as prayers that are performed after Tarawih.
Yeah,
not after Tarawih. Isha.
Yeah, after Tarawih.
For the record. So,
after
Tarawih. And the,
yeah.
I mean, to be technical, you go to sleep and then you wake up and then you perform those prayers. That's the tahajjud.
Yeah. And by the way, if I were to stay up all night, I would still make my time for tahajjud. But point okay. being is that, yeah, in addition to whatever Tarawih okay. I have done,
okay.
And I, by the way, when I wake up in the morning, I don't like to be groggy. I like to be fresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's an entire day. I've got a lot going on. And so that's kind of how I end up spending, you know, my day in Ramadan. You know, of course, I may have work. I have school. I'm teaching. I've right. got all these other, we all have certain responsibilities.
So if you could give us the importance of suhoor.
the Prophet very clearly mentions tasahharu, make suhoor, fa inna fihi baraka. There's baraka in it. And the Sahaba would say, the Nabi alayhi salatu wasalam encouraged the Sahaba to delay their suhoor. Now, delay doesn't mean you're having it when the adhan is happening. Delay means, you know, the last third of the night. Like, don't have your suhoor at 12 a.m. and then go to sleep and then wake up straight for Fajr. The idea was that you would wake up slightly before dawn, true dawn, when Fajr came in and you had your suhoor at the time. It's been narrated that the time between the Sahaba's suhoor and their Fajr prayer was the amount of time it took to pray recite 50 verses of the Quran. Mm. And since we're on this, just very, very quickly, I might as well mention it. There's a hadith, there's a narration that says that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that when the adhan is happening, if your drinking vessel is in your hand, you know, drink the water. Mm. Finish drinking it. But in fact, Sheikh Faraz Khan writes this in his Maraqi al-Sa'dat. He says that adhan was not the adhan for Fajr. That adhan was a pre-Fajr adhan to indicate that it was the end time of eating. And when the adhan by the time the adhan for Fajr happened, everyone had already stopped eating minutes before. And people grossly misunderstand that hadith. But in any case, to answer your suhoor question,
right.
And you know, different people eat different things for suhoor. I'm a cereal person. My suhoors are fairly simple. You know, just one of those healthy cereals with cold milk, and I'm good to go.
Yeah.
I would advise a lot of protein, but that's just it. You'll thank me in the middle of Ramadan because you will have more energy. I promise you. Protein just takes longer for your body to digest. But anyway, digressing a little.
I love the takeaway of number one. Don't let the fear of a late night deter you from just Isha.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and yeah. I love obviously the importance of tahajjud. And I mean, one thing my mind's turning is like, let's make dua before Maghrib a family activity and maybe assign the kids the duas, right?
You know, I was just telling people, I don't pray. In the last 20, 25 years, I have not been to anyone's home for iftar. I don't do iftaris.
Just about to go there. Okay. Thank you.
I don't do iftaris at all. Yeah. I just, for me, within 20 to 25 minutes, I've made iftar, prayed Maghrib, and had dinner, and on my way to the masjid, I've recited a half a juz of the Quran. And once I arrive at the masjid, from the time I arrive all the way until Isha prayer, I get in another juz and a half.
Right.
And there have been times when I live in San Jose, and Pleasanton is 30 miles away. There are times when I have to go to I used to go to Pleasanton for Isha prayer once or twice a week. And I used to drive 30 minutes and still be one of the first five people in the masjid in Pleasanton for Isha, and a few hundred people would walk in, you know, in the next 30 minutes.
And the only way you can pull that off is not socializing during iftar time.
Yeah. I guess I was raised with this sort of non-social, you know, for many
that's
people,
good,
for many people, Ramadan is about socializing.
I was just about to say, exactly.
Like every day during iftar, they've got something going on. And by the way, you know, if that's what their Ramadan is like, but I do feel that there is an entire other element to Ramadan, a scholarly perspective to Ramadan that we have seen our pious predecessors, the awliya, the saints, my grandfather, your grandfather, grandmother, you know, their Ramadan was not about socializing. Their Ramadans were very, very secluded. You know, they were kind of doing their own thing. So, you know, some people ask me and say, well, Imam Tahir, there's a great reward in feeding people iftari, you know? And so that's a very common question. So, you know, I have to throw a party. And if I throw a party, I have to go to other people's parties. And I said, it's very simple. You don't have to do anything. You can sponsor iftars. There's all these masjids, institutions that are serving iftars to their communities or to their students. Or I can go online and sponsor an iftar at my local masjid, and you know, through one check I can feed 150 people. But one of the things that we end up doing at home is that maybe 3-4 times during the month of Ramadan, my wife will cook up a storm. And it all gets packed in containers and bags. And the night before, some of her friends will get text messages, don't cook tomorrow. Nice. And my job after Asr, while I'm reading my Quran, is to go and deliver these bags to our various different, you know, close neighbors or close friends. Not too far. And that's how we do Ramadan. And so we also get to partake in feeding others with food that we've cooked with our own hands and not just written a check, but also at the same time, you know, the time is the sanctity of the time is maintained.
I know you have a hard stop coming
Yes,
up.
I do.
So I want to be mindful of that, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. And I know, especially this Ramadan, as you know, we see what's happening in Gaza and in other parts of the world. What can we do that is perhaps, you know, special this Ramadan, you know, for our brothers and sisters in Gaza?
To start with, I think really sincerely heartfelt dua multiple times a day. Easier said than done. Ask an average Muslim, when was the last time you made dua for the people of Gaza? Maybe during Jummah namaz when the imam said it. But did I really sit down and do it? Maybe we have, inshallah. But like heartfelt dua, you know, a few times a day for those individuals. Contribute your funds, whatever is possible, to reliable institutions that can actually make sure that our funds are going to make it there. And I think those are the two big things that we should be doing. But also at the same time, you know, not neglecting your own community and the needs of your own local community. And similarly, just, you know, making sure that we remain conscious and cognizant of what's happening around. And it's just, you know, not just, of course, prayers and sadaqah, but whatever else that needs to be done as well. You know, this is an election year, so.
No, I appreciate that very much. And frankly, appreciate everything. I should have known that 90 minutes with someone as interesting as you would not be enough. But inshallah, we will have you back on. Please remember us and this small little show in your du'as. We would be most appreciative of it.
Bit tawfiq and bil ikhlas, inshallah.
Inshallah.
And let this be a means of guidance and reward and ajr and closeness to Allah and bringing the community together. In more ways than we can ever imagine, inshallah.
I'm going to forego my usual conclusion because that is a beautiful way to conclude as we approach this beautiful month. So thank you so much.
Barakallahu feekum.